It's 12 Enough, Season 8, Episode 12, with your host, Jonathan Malone, and guest host, Scott Paith. Podcast about Christian faith and culture in the modern age. Your host, Jonathan Malone, is the pastor of the First Baptist Church of East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Scott Paith is the associate professor of religious studies at DePaul University in Chicago. This podcast is brought to you by cliched young adult novels, adolescent love interest, teenage angst, a bit of supernatural, guaranteed bestseller, and The Hanging Chad. Just let go. Just let go. And we're back. Scott, how long has it been since you heard a Hanging Chad joke?
Actually, I heard one just you know what? It was on what, Better Call Saul just last week. There was a Hanging Chad joke.
Okay. You know, I haven't watched Better Call Saul. Is it good?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I just got caught up with it because, you know, my family has New Mexico connections. So,
oh, okay.
So I'm always sort of interested in it. My wife is sort of appalled by the fact that, you know, Albuquerque, New Mexico, where she's from, is now permanently associated in the public mind with meth. And corruption and murder
and good science
and good excellent chemists
excellent chemists. So
high school chemistry teachers who, you know, are clearly much more brilliant than chemistry teachers elsewhere in the country.
How many papers have been written about the name Heisenberg and what kind of meta reference that is on the whole show and character, do you think?
I don't know. I couldn't begin to guess.
How many poor philosophy professors have had to read, you know, sophomore or junior papers going through that, thinking that they're, you know, and the kids thinking they're brilliant with this revelation.
I know. Well, if they start showing up with pork pie hats and goatees, then.
Right.
But I also have to say, with regard to the first sponsor, I had no idea that John Green was a fan of your show.
That's very nice. Well, you know, and that sort of came up, you know, so my oldest son, he's 16, he's working on this English project, and on Friday, he comes to my wife and I and says, can you help me with my English project? And we're like, of course, what do you need? He says, well, if you could read this book so that you'll have an idea of what I'm writing. Yeah, right there. Read the book, because that's the one I read. I'm writing a report so that you can tell me if I'm on track or not. Oh, we're like... And I said, you know, my wife's in school now, so I said, all right, I'll do it because, you know, I'm just a pastor and I only work one day a week. And I don't read, so, right? So I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. When is this thing due? He's like, it's Tuesday, so you have to have it read by Monday. This is on Friday. But, yeah, so Scott, you know, I mean, it's not an easy thing just to plow through a book. And it's like 250 page book. So it's not huge, but that's substantial. But luckily, it's a young adult novel. 2 days.
Yeah.
Two days of not many hours reading and all those things, except, yeah, even the supernatural, they were all in there.
I was going to ask, so if you're talking about a young adult novel, so there are a few fundamental questions. First of all, is it dystopian?
This one, not so much, but it, in a person's inner psyche, yes. Well, it takes place in a mental institution, so yes.
Is it a future mental institution?
No, current, but still that's... Just a sad place to be.
So they're supernatural. Are they vampires?
No, an imagined twin.
Oh, okay.
So that one's just a hint of the supernatural.
So yeah, I was gonna. So it's like a psychological novel.
Then. Yeah, this one was.
So this one is basically. It sounds to me like so. Category one is dystopian.
Yep.
Category two is vampires or other supernatural creatures, and then category three is troubled young person in the contemporary world.
And that's what this was.
This was okay.
And of course, there were love interests and.
Love interests. And was this a witty, troubled young person in the modern world? Or was this a grim, troubled young person in the modern world?
Oh, grim. This one was grim.
Grim, yeah.
Yeah.
So what I like about John Green is that all of his troubled young people are very witty.
Oh, well, that's nice.
And they write, you know, and they write and or talk like 45-year-old white guys, you know, which is appropriate since they basically all sound like John Green.
Right. Well, you know, when you've got a hook.
Yeah, exactly.
You stay with it.
Doesn't matter if 15-year-old girls with cancer. They're going to sound like 45-year-old guy from Indianapolis.
Well, cancer makes you wise immediately.
I hope I never have to find out whether or not that's true. But
that's not something you really could respond to, Scott, nor do you need to. And I want to point out, so for the listeners,
I don't need extra wisdom that bad.
Yeah, right. Yeah, nobody. I'm going to get like some kind of comment, like, how dare you make that generalization of cancer patients? Like, what are you going to say? So for folks who can't see, Scott's wearing a T-shirt that, you know, transcends the young adult genre. But it does have a young, well, it has a very dystopian future. We're not going to say what it is yet. It's a very dystopian future. It has a young main character who's not really clear how they can fit in with this society and has a lot of angst and pushing back against the institution.
It does.
But this is Brave New World.
It is.
That's the shirt that Scott's wearing. So Aldous Huxley was not writing a young adult novel.
Didn't think he was writing an adult novel.
But today, it probably would be labeled as such.
Well, when did you read it? Because I read it in high school.
I think I waited until it was in between seminary and then doctoral work.
Oh, okay.
Because that's when, after seminary, I'm like, I'm going to start reading all those books I never got to read. And that was one of them. And then I went back to school and stopped.
Yeah. That's around the time that I read, I actually started reading C.S. Lewis, like Narnia Chronicles.
Oh.
It's in college. So even though those are clearly not even young adult, those are clearly children's novels.
Right.
I read them for the first time in college. So yeah.
My nephew, who's 6, was reading them and he went to his dad. He doesn't go to church on a regular basis. And he's like, this Aslan guy, there's something about him that seems really different. They're like, well, you got it there, kid. You got it. So, Scott, it's good to have you on the show. Have you back on the show. My loyal listeners might remember, Scott, when we talked about how important it is to do philosophy when doing theology, but to always remember that theology is indeed the queen of the sciences, and philosophy will only get so far. Just remember that. Remember that when you're reading your Nietzsche and your Hegel. It's only going to take you so far. So it's good to have you back. And you are there in Chicago. Lovely. Is it warm yet?
It's warm today.
Yeah.
It's actually been a pretty mild winter.
It really has been.
Yeah. And believe me, I'm not complaining because the last couple of winters have been brutal here.
Right.
So, but today's like, it might even get up to the 60s.
Oh, wow. That's really big.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We're looking at maybe even 70 degrees this week, which is...
I'll take it.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I'm happy for that. I'm very happy for that. And Scott and I attended... the ill-fated Andover Newton Theological School.
Are we going to talk about that today?
Well, if you want that to be your rileage, your rant, you can.
I don't know that I have anything to rant about, but I certainly think it's certainly an interesting topic.
Right, it sure is. We should have done that. Well, maybe the next time. So we went to the seminary together. We spent many nights smoking pipes and discussing theology and why the school needs to maintain its Trinitarian identity. I mean, that was one of my favorite.
Only they had listened.
If only they had listened, but they didn't, and now God's punishing them. I think that's a clear and ethical conclusion for all of this. So it's good to have you back on the show, Scott.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And so with all that, why don't we get right into our Rileage?
Rileage. I'm talking about Rileage.
So, Scott and I, after deliberation, our real rants and Rileages we're going to save for the main topic, which will be, for our listeners, the next episode. then you'll really hear us go off. But for now, we are going to talk a little bit about Andover Newton, and what some might describe as their tragic downfall, others might say as their hopeful step into the future. So all right. this is my take on it, of what's going on there. Andover Newton, which is still, for a little bit longer, the oldest graduate school in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
1807?
Something like that.
Something
yeah.
like that, yeah.
I mean, it's been... Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, because of course there was the Yale and Harvard, and you know those folks were training ministers in the 17th and 18th centuries, right?
Yeah.
But then Andover Newton was the first sort of freestanding graduate theological seminary, right. In the country.
Yeah. So then they were proud of that.
Yeah.
For a while, and they did it because they were Trinitarian, and Harvard was going towards a Unitarian path, and some faculty said we can't go this way, and they took a stand.
Well, and of course, you know the whole story about like why it's like the Andover Harvard Library there at Harvard was because at a certain point the two faculties decided that they were going to unify,
right?
And
right,
Harvard, right. And so it became so Andover Newton joined Harvard, and then apparently they decided that this was not a good match precisely because of the Unitarian Trinitarian split,
right?
And so the faculties voted to have a you know, I guess, a relatively amicable divorce. But the libraries decided to stay together.
Yeah.
So that's the story that I heard.
Right, right.
So as a result, when we were students at Andover Newton, we got to have, you know, borrowing privileges at all of the Harvard libraries.
Right. Right. We had visitation rights, you could say.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Because that is how we view our books as scholars, as are our children.
Oh, right? My gosh, you are so right.
Yeah.
You are so right. And I've loaned out one book of mine, and it's been plaguing me for 2 weeks now. It really has been. Anyway, so yeah. So Andover Newton, the enrollment's been going down, like many, many seminaries across the country.
Yeah.
Enrollment's been going down. Full-time students especially have been going down. Costs have been going up. They have a beautiful campus with a lot of buildings that cost a lot of money to obtain, and they're not connected with a university.
Right.
You know, Harvard is, Yale, Duke. I mean, if you think of those other divinity schools, they have an institution that they can kind of lean on. We don't. Andover doesn't have that.
No, and it really. I mean, and any freestanding theological seminary is going through the exact same thing right now.
Yeah.
And this is, Dana, when we talk about. I mean, I'm not mad
right.
about what happened at Andover Newton, and I'm certainly not mad at the faculty or the administration. Who were there when it happened?
Oh yeah.
But I'm upset at the sort of the general trend that has been going on in theological education over the last 20 years, certainly, you know, since we were in
right.
the seminary.
Yeah.
This has been an ongoing issue, but it really hit hard just within the last decade.
Mm.
Because I mean, Andover Newton. As you probably know, they were actually doing fairly well for a while in the early part of the last decade. Mm-hmm. They built a new chapel,
right?
There were campus improvements. They had that agreement to unify with Hebrew College,
right? Yeah, Hebrew College built on the campus.
Yeah, and I think there was another seminary that they were affiliated with too. That was sort of because they were sort of like a three seminary model. They were working on something along those lines,
right?
And I don't think all of those plans came to fruition, but it felt like things were really looking up institutionally for Andover Newton. And then the next thing we know, or at least the next thing I know,
yeah,
you know, we get this email saying, "Well, we're looking at some options, and there's going to be a notification about this." And I, as soon as I saw that, I'm like, "Well, that can't be good."
Right.
You know, this is you don't send out an email warning people about these kinds of things unless you've got some fairly serious bad news coming down the pike.
Right. Right. Yeah. It did feel like it came out of nowhere.
Yeah. But you know? I mean, I don't know. See, I don't know if people on the East Coast who were alums had been privy to a lot of this stuff prior to those announcements. But it's certainly I'm far enough away that I don't keep up with the chatter on these things. So it sort of hit me like a bolt from the blue.
Yeah, it came out of nowhere for me. Although, here's where my rant with this is, and I have a different rant too. So
yeah.
This isn't mine.
Okay, you know, this is a sub rant.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, a sub rant. We had the American Baptists had their national gathering that summer before the news came out, you know, as we do every other year. And always there are some representatives from the seminaries, Andover Newton sends folks. Every year I've gone, the president has been there. You know, Ben Griffin came, Nick, I can't remember his last name.
Carter, I think.
Yeah, right. Nick Carter came, you know, and there'd be a dinner, and they'd say, you know, the state of the seminary is good, you know, and you know, they do whatever they're supposed to do.
Right.
This year, or this time, this summer, they sent students and one faculty who had already been told that they were not going to have a job in 6 months. And that was it for the school's representation for the American Baptist. And what ticked me off about that, it was like they were writing us off.
Yeah.
It's saying, you guys aren't important to us anymore. You don't have a presence on our campus, and we're just not going to try anymore.
Yeah.
And the American Baptists historically have been one of, you know, a strong part of that school.
That campus.
That campus,
we attended was the American Baptist Seminary.
Yeah.
When it was Andover Theological School was up in Andover, and then the New Theological Institute in Newton, that was the Baptist campus.
Right. Yeah. So to move away now, granted, there have been less and less Baptist students going there, but you know, and we can wonder why that might be. You know, that's its own thing. But that's part of where my rant is. I feel like it's a sense of, you know, we're going to go after where the money is, and the money seems more with the Unitarian Universalist than with the Baptist and maybe even the Congregationalist.
Right. Well, you know, and I think part of the reason for that is that, of course, if you're a Unitarian,
yeah,
and you're in the Boston area,
right,
there's the first question is if you want to train for the ministry, why not go to Harvard?
Right.
And Harvard was always sort of the first stop, I think, for Unitarian students, and a lot of them took Unitarian polity there and other classes of that kind.
Right.
But I think that the reason why a lot of Unitarians, and of course some of our Unitarian friends may correct me on this online, but sure. I think the reason was because Harvard was always very good at giving people an academic theological education,
right.
Whereas Andover Newton was where they came if they really wanted to train for pastoral ministry.
Yeah, that's
Harvard
been the
did a very good job at that in a way that Harvard didn't.
Right,
and
that's
so
fair.
We attracted a lot of Unitarians because of that.
Right,
and then of course the problem was that the Unitarians had one particular angle on this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The Baptists tended to have a moderately more conservative, but not substantially more conservative.
But that's, I think that's fair.
That stuff. And then, of course, the UCC folks kind of walked the middle on some of that.
They just want to make sure everyone's happy.
Well, yes, right. It was sort of kind of a confirmation of the old joke that UCC stands for Unitarians Considering Christ.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Sort of kind of walking kind of in the middle of those two things. And so I think it's in one way, it's understandable that there may have been sort of declining numbers of American Baptist students at the same time that there was an increasing number of Unitarian students.
Right.
But I think the problem really doesn't come down to that shift, although I think that shift is regrettable.
Yeah.
At least it's regrettable insofar as it meant fewer Baptist students.
Right. Yeah.
I think having more Unitarians was fine because I liked the ferment that came from having, you know, you on my right and, you know, the Unitarian students on my left and, you know, having the ability for all of us to engage in conversation with one another.
Conversation for the listeners to know. Conversation for Scott was arguing why the Trinity was essential.
I still believe that's so.
And rightfully so. But yes, but no, it was very good to have people saying, I don't know why you need to have the Trinity to push that way. Where if we went to a more evangelical or even just Orthodox school, the idea of even questioning the Trinity with people would be like, why would you question it? Clearly.
It never came up at Princeton, for example.
It never came up at Princeton?
No, I mean, well, you talk about the Trinity.
Oh, right.
But there was rarely someone who would say, "Meh, I don't need the Trinity." or and you certainly wouldn't have someone as many of these, some of the Unitarian students.
Right.
Would come and say, and I'm not so sure we really even need this whole God thing.
Right, yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, the Trinity is that. But of course, the Unitarians are funny that way because, of course, then you also had Trinitarian Unitarians.
Oh, I know. They were a riot.
Yeah. I mean, so the Unitarians are sort of so wide open in that respect.
Yeah. But you were making a good point. Sorry.
Yeah, no. But so the problem is that it isn't so much that there was that kind of intellectual ferment, which I liked.
Yeah.
The problem is a problem that is besetting all theological seminaries that rely on their denominations
yeah.
for their support because the denominations have decreasing numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore they can't send as many students to the seminaries.
Right.
You know, they come out of the seminaries, there aren't as many jobs because there are fewer churches, there are fewer members, and so they're sending less money. So if you aren't a divinity school affiliated with a university, you have a serious uphill battle ahead of you to kind of keep the lights on.
Yeah.
And that is the problem that Andover Newton seemed to have smacked right into, is that they said, you know, we are independent.
Mm-hmm.
We rely on the churches. And I say this as a UCC member,
mm-hmm.
the churches, particularly the UCC, but I think all of the churches that were sending students there, the churches failed to step up.
Yeah.
The denominations failed to step up. And this is a problem that not only Andover Newton, mm-hmm. but all of the freestanding denominational seminaries are going to have to grapple with. They're going to have to find ways to consolidate, to deal with fewer students, because they just don't have the resources coming in from the denominations.
Right. I think that I like that point that the churches failed to step up. You know, I'm on a committee right now that's in charge of credentialing pastors in Rhode Island. And we are wrestling with the idea of how do we help someone who is, you know, very second career, who's not going to go to seminary, you know, working part-time, bivocational pastor, how do we help them achieve certain proficiencies that we think are important for ministry
mm-hmm.
Without going to seminary?
Right.
If that's even possible. You know, and then and beyond that, how do we help the churches understand why this is important?
Yeah. And I think that is really crucial, because we both come from traditions that value an educated clergy.
Right.
And when we say, you know, well, we want someone who has a college degree,
right,
and a Master of Divinity degree, the reason why is because we believe that what you get from the training that's required is essential for ministry.
Right, yeah.
You know, of course, we've talked about, you know, the thing that frustrates me is when you get people in ministry
mm-hmm.
who say, well, I don't really understand why it's important to know theology. I just want to pastor to people.
I know.
Yeah. And the problem isn't that they can't pastor to people without sort of an in-depth knowledge of, you know, how to conjugate Greek verbs, you know, or why, you know, understand the significance of Schleiermacher on the evolution of 19th century theology. But the reason is because what you learn in learning that stuff isn't just information. You learn about particular ways of thinking about what it is that we believe as Christians.
Yeah.
And that is something that you lose if you don't go through that educational process. So we have people coming in,
mm-hmm.
second career people, people who don't have a traditional educational background. They sincerely want to pastor churches.
Right.
They sincerely want to serve. And many of them have gifts that will enable them to do that.
Yeah.
But we're now in a situation where we are increasingly not able to provide them with the educations that they greatly need in order to do that job well. And so as a result, we have poorer preaching.
Yep.
We have less theologically informed pastors.
Yep.
So as a result, the interest in theology declines. And then what you wind up with, at least I don't know how this is in the American Baptist these days, but in the UCC, we wind up with yet another iteration of the God is still speaking campaign.
Oh.
Which is awful.
You don't like that campaign, huh?
Awful, awful, awful. I so hate the God is still speaking campaign. And I hate it if for no other reason. I have about a dozen reasons to hate it. But if for no other reason, then because it seems to require denominational officials to use the phrase "the still speaking God" in every declaration.
Oh, that is kind of obnoxious, huh?
And I'm just like, God, please stop. We have 2,000 years of tradition. Do we have to treat Gracie Allen like she's our most profound theologian?
So you want God to just be quiet for a little bit. That's
denomination to be quiet about God is still. I want them to come up with a. I want them to come up with a slogan that may actually be rooted in our theological or biblical traditions. Come up with a way of advertising ourselves that would make people say, oh, "That sounds interesting." You know, it's like God is still speaking. Sounds like, you know, well, I can just make it up as I go along.
Well, isn't that the UCC way?
That's how many people think the UCC way is.
Yeah, I know. There's so so Mike Denton, if you're listening, Mike Denton was on the show not long ago. I don't know if you know Mike at all.
No.
He's the executive, the conference minister of the Pacific Northwest Conference of the UCC. So he's up there among the mucky mucks of your folks. So Mike, if you're listening, Scott Paith is willing to work with you to come up with a new slogan.
I'm going to get hate mail from denominational folks about this probably, but
you know, they'll probably say we're happy someone's interested.
You would think.
Because I think the American Baptist slogan is, we're still here. Give us a try.
Your slogan is no, the other Baptists.
Right, yeah, that really is it. Yeah. We're the other kinds of Baptists, right? I think that the Andrew Newton closing is systemic of a lot of changes that's happening, especially with the mainline Protestant religious landscape.
And we have to find new ways to train people theologically.
Yeah, and that's what I've been wrestling with. I know in a very recent Christian Century, they had an interview with Molly Marshall, who's the president of Central Baptist in Kansas. Because there's another freestanding, and it's only American Baptist. It doesn't even have another denomination. And she's done some stuff. I haven't read it enough to know, but she's done some stuff that has given that seminary a real future.
Mm.
So somehow she figured out.
Yeah, well, and the problem is you want to be able, I would not want Andover Newton in whatever form it exists in the future.
Right.
And I'm sort of got my fingers crossed that the Yale thing happens.
Yeah, it'd be nice.
That would be nice. And particularly because a Connecticut guy, you know.
I think that's right. Yeah. So it's easier to visit the campus then.
Yeah. I'm going to have to find an excuse to make a pilgrimage to Andover Newton before they close the old campus.
Because, oh, yeah.
Because I haven't been back in a long time.
Well, let me know. I'll join you because I'm real close.
Well, that's true. We should make an appointment. We should get a whole bunch of people together. We go down to Union Street.
That would be, yeah, we should.
Yeah.
We should.
Have a goodbye party for Andover. Yeah.
I think that'd be nice.
Yeah, it would be nice. But the problem, whatever form it takes in the future, it has to be able to train people, but train people in a way that keeps them theologically on top of things.
Yeah.
But also can help them become the kind of pastors that the next generation of church is going to need.
Yeah, that's really big.
Yeah, and this is the thing that I've been thinking a lot about this. Because there are all sorts of alternative models of seminary education that are sort of beginning to pop up.
Right.
And my attitude is the seminaries that are still standing and the ones that are still training people, I think we have to begin to think not about sort of what is going to work for the next century.
Right.
There's so much ferment right now in theology in terms of the way that churches and seminaries are responding to things and the way that culture is changing. We need to be thinking like 7 or 10 years out.
Yeah.
And we need to say, okay, in 7 or 10 years, everything's going to be different, right? So we can't plan for 50 years. We can't plan for 25 years. We have to plan for 7 to 10 years.
Yeah.
Right. And we need to say, what's it going to look like in 7 years? And then in 7 years, we need to say, now everything's changed again. Because 7 years ago, Andover Newton didn't seem like they were that bad off.
Right. Right. You know, maybe if they just stuck it out for 7 more years.
Well, who knows?
I mean,
if they could have, I'm sure they would have. But the problem is, if you say, hey, things are looking good now.
Right.
Therefore, they're going to look good in 10 years.
Right.
We can't make that assumption anymore.
Yeah.
And we think about the question of, what are we training people to do now? What do we need to be training people to do in 5 years? You know, and how are things going to look different? How are the churches going to be different? How is the theological landscape going to be different? How's the culture going to be different? And how are we going to train people to deal with that sort of ever-changing culture?
I think that's, I just wrote that down as a good topic for another episode. It's just theological education in general.
Yeah.
I mean, if nothing else, folks, you know, our listeners, I hope you take away the importance of seminary education, you know, and, you know, with Baptists, we, because we have, you know, that strong evangelical part of who we are, there is this anti-intellectualism that's kind of a part of our ethos. It's folded in there. And there's that tension is always there. And I get that if you're called, you're called, and anyone can preach, right? But, you know, Scott is so right that if you consistently preach Sunday to Sunday to Sunday without any kind of training or formation, you're just not feeding people.
Yeah.
And you're not doing them any services.
Right. And you end up preaching, you wind up preaching the same five sermons.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
Yeah,
yeah.
You've got, it's like, you know, you change the wording a little bit, but you've got nothing new,
right?
Right. You've got to be able to go back to the texts, go back to the tradition, and constantly kind of be able to find new things there.
And
that's not something that's not something you can do on your own. You have to be trained to do that.
Right. Yeah. And we're talking about the care of people's souls.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, no. Ultimately, it's in God's hands. Yes. Yeah. But. And I've seen, you know, how many people, Scott, have you met that who have been scarred by bad theology?
Oh, yeah.
It, you know, it's horrific. So this stuff is very important. And I would say, you know, this is, you know, well, Howard Wass, I know, likes to put things in stark terms because that's just how he operates. But he said it's a matter, he would say it's a matter of life and death.
Yeah.
And in a way, it is. So.
Yeah. And I wonder if actually, and perhaps this is a good note to end on, I wonder if perhaps the future of the church is probably a lot more Howard Wassian than I've been willing to admit up till this point. I know.
I should write this down. Scott is saying Howard Wass might have perhaps a little bit been right.
Well, I just wonder, the church is not, I don't think Howard Wass is right on some, I've always thought Howard Wass is interesting.
Right.
He's been right on a few things, but the question is, What is the nature of the church of the future going to be, right? And is it going to be, a countercultural bulwark, right?
Right.
Or is it going to be, or is it going to be completely assimilated?
So this is great. This is a great segue into my rant.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to stop now because I've been talking too long about this.
Well, no, that's quite all right. This is a segue to mine.
Okay.
Very recently, I got an email from a rabbi who lives in the town. Where the church I serve is, asking the clergy in that town to sign a letter for the school board. And it's basically asking the school board that when you look at the school calendar, please make sure Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Good Friday are days off.
Hmm.
Right? And you think, well, all right, that seems fine. But of course, because I'm Baptist, I'm just, you know, always going to be contrarian in one way or another. And my thought was, well, what about the other religious holidays?
Hmm.
Right. So my response was, I would rather, you know, I'm not sure if I can sign this because it's still creating a culture of power for some. It's saying there are some religions that we need to favor.
Right.
You know, Christianity, we've been in that place for a long time. And I would love it if we just completely were removed from that. That's the Howard Wassian thing. I would love it if we were a countercultural church. I mean, so I would rather send a letter out to the school board saying, please don't give us off. Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah or Good Friday or anything. And don't give us Easter or Christmas anymore.
Yeah.
But please ensure that any student that takes a religious day will not be penalized. It won't count as an absence.
Yeah.
There, you know, if there's an exam, they can make it up. You won't have standardized testing during Ramadan,
mm-hmm.
During the whole month. You know, something like that, I think. Or if you do, that the students can say, because I something where the onus is on the individual to step forward and say, this is a religious day for me, to tell the teacher, I can't be here that day because I'm going to, that's what I would rather.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, there's two models of secularism
right.
at work here, right? I mean, so the one model is the kind of secularism of accommodation.
Yeah.
That says, we need to ensure, because we live in a religiously pluralistic society, that everyone who has a sort of a religious outlook has their religious particularity sort of recognized and honored in terms of the way that we organize society.
Right.
And that's, I think that tends to be the American way of doing things.
Yeah.
But you know, mostly.
That's when we put a manger and a menorah up there. So like, there, right. We got everyone. Some candles for Kwanzaa, right. And we're good.
And then of course by the time all is said and done, there's a Baphomet statue, sitting outside.
That's right.
However you may feel about that, I think that is the logical conclusion of a secularism of inclusion. Right.
Right.
The other is sort of a secularism of neutrality. Right?
Yeah.
Basically, what we do is we create a secular sphere that is completely naked.
Yeah.
The sort of the John Richard Newhouse. Right. It's a naked public square. And then, of course, that's more like the French model, right? Where they say, well, our they call it laicité, right?
Yep.
Our public sphere is totally devoid of religion, and religion is a wholly private affair, and the state will not do anything to accommodate any particular religion.
Right. Right.
Of course, in France, Christianity still gets pride of place.
Right. Right. It's
causing more problems for observant Muslims than it does for Christians or Jews by and large. But that's a different model of secularism. And I think they both have a place. So they both have a place, I think, in the conversation.
Okay.
But they create all sorts of difficulties in terms of thinking about who gets included and who gets excluded and how.
Right.
Right. When you have one major religious perspective in society and everything else is sort of second class citizen, then that religion sort of simply dictates the terms,
which is what
Christianity had it for the longest time.
Yeah.
Now we've abandoned that sort of centrality of Christianity, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
But now we have to figure out how we deal with the sort of irreducible pluralism of society.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's, I look at that and I say, there's no way we're going to be able to ask them to include every religious holiday or day of religious observance, because the Church of the Spaghetti Monster they'll claim their days and I guess in the eyes of the law, that's legitimate.
And I think that is the issue, right? Because of course, part of the problem is who gets to decide what constitutes religion.
Oh yeah.
And then who gets to decide what constitutes legitimate religion?
Right.
I got some hate mail last year.
Oh, good for you.
Because I know it's always it makes people are paying attention at least.
Right. Yeah.
I was interviewed about the Scientology Center that was opening here in Chicago.
Oh God.
And I don't know a lot about Scientology. I know what I've read. But I'm not an expert in the field. But I was sort of asked, just generally speaking, about this question of, is it a problem that this particular Scientology Center was opening up? And I said, well, look, as long as Scientology is granted religious protection, then it should be treated like any other religion, And so from that perspective, no. I mean, certainly you should prevent a Scientology center from opening up any more than you want to prevent a mosque or a Hindu temple from opening up. One can have their problems with Scientology as a religion, but still say that the people who want to practice it should be allowed to practice it in the way that they see fit.
Right.
Well, as you probably know, there are a lot of people who are, I guess you call them recovering Scientologists.
Yeah.
But people who have been in Scientology have been very badly treated because of it. Because Scientology, from all the reports that I have, has this nasty habit of sort of isolating people from their families if they don't believe the same things. And
right. It's cultish.
Exactly. And, which goes along with sort of the popular image of Scientology as a cult.
Right.
The problem is, so I got the hate mail.
Right.
Basically saying, if you knew what you were talking about Scientology, you would recognize that it is a cult.
Right.
And therefore doesn't deserve religious protection. That was the substance of it.
Oh, yeah, which is an interesting jump.
Yeah, and I'm like, well, no, if it's a cult, it's still a religion.
Right.
The problem is how do you ensure that people who need protection from what they view as being the abuses of that religion have a way to get satisfaction, right? They have a way to get away. They can,
right.
they can deal with the abuse. I think that's all legitimate stuff to talk about. But the point at which you say this Scientology center shouldn't open because Scientology is a cult is a point at which you just slam smack dab into the First Amendment.
Yeah. So my proclivity, and I the listeners should know that I'm noticing on your bookshelf at least 10 copies of L. Ron Hubbard's book. So I don't know if that's also influences you, but I'm just letting people know.
He is like the worst writer on the face of the planet.
Awful, yeah. But he figured out a way to sell his books.
That's right. Have you ever seen this YouTube thing? It's Ayn Rand and L. Ron Hubbard conspiring to create, to create the kind of the wackiest movement.
No, but it sounds wonderful.
I'll send you a link.
Okay, yeah, because Ayn Rand's another one. my proclivity would be towards that. You know, the state just saying we're not going to favor any religion over another. I know that a lot of it is also if you live in a town where there's a lot of Jews and a lot of Christians, but not a lot of anyone else, right. That's what's going to be favored.
Yeah.
But I worry, you know, all it takes is just one Muslim, one Hindu, I think, and you say, well, we've got to make space for them.
Yeah.
So anyway, so you know, if there's a rant in this, it's about still the idea of a Christian dominated culture.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that we of course will get Good Friday off. I really wouldn't mind if they didn't have Good Friday off. And I'll tell my kids, if you are going to participate in worship services on that Friday, then we will take you out of school. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, if you're not planning on it, go to school.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'd much rather have my kids in – of course, my kids go to a Catholic school.
Oh, so you're definitely getting that day off.
They get Good Friday off. And I teach at a Catholic school. So
right. So you have to get Good Friday off.
And, in fact, of course, the joke around here is that because we get very few days off
right.
at all, and one of the very few that we get off is Good Friday. And so the joke that goes around here is that Jesus had to die to get us a day off at DePaul University. But it is a Catholic university, so it's to be expected. Right. But a public school, yeah. I mean, it's if you're not going to go to a Good Friday service, go to school.
Yeah. Yeah. Otherwise, I would even take it as offensive as a Christian.
Yeah.
To right. take it as a day just to relax or go to the beach or, I don't know if you go to the beach, not this year.
Certainly not this year.
Yeah. But I mean, as a, for a fun day that we get an extra long weekend, that's kind of offensive.
It certainly misses the point.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Jesus didn't die so you could have an extra day. Just
exactly.
to relax.
Despite what they say around here.
Right. So just real curious, do you get the Feast of the Immaculate Conception off?
Nope.
No? Wow. There.
It's like literally Good Friday.
It's, Mary it's could Christmas be break. Immaculately conceived, and that's still not enough to get you a day off.
Oh.
I mean, the Pope, one of the few times the Pope uses that infallibility clause to bring something new in.
No, but we just this year, for the first time, got Martin Luther King Day off.
Oh, wow. And he's not even Catholic.
No, it's a Baptist. A good seat. We honor the Baptists.
And on behalf of all the Baptists, you're welcome. All right, folks, that's a good round. So, folks, first, take theological education seriously. Andover Newton, we wish you best where however you end up. I don't know if I'm going to send any more alumni dollars, though. I have to really think about that. And, Christians, you don't need to have everything just for you. Suffer a little bit. See what it feels like. So I know that when the listeners get this episode, they haven't heard the brilliant conversation that Scott and I just had about politics and the church. And it was really amazing. Really just earth-shattering. And I'm sorry to the listeners that you have to wait at least another week before getting it. But your life will be at least 50% better after you listen to it.
Only 50%?
Well, yeah, I'm not going to go. I got a hedge, man. I don't want people writing in saying, my life only improved so much. I'm like, I don't even know how you quantify.
32.1%.
Yeah, right. Yeah, how do you quantify if my life has improved after listening to a podcast or not? I'll leave that up to the statisticians to figure out. That's their job.
That's right.
So we're going to look at Romans, Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 13, and let's do verses. The thing I found said 1-7. So let's just do 1-7.
Okay.
It's a nice little section. So I'm going to read it from I'm doing this from the Authorized New Revised Standard Version, the kind that Jesus prefers. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those authorities that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Do you wish to have no fear of the authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive its approval. For it is God's servant for your good. But if you do what is wrong, you should be afraid, for the authority does not bear the sword in vain. It is the servant of God to execute wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be subject not only because of wrath, but also because of conscience. For the same reason, you must also pay taxes. Oh, nice. For the authorities are God's servants, busy with this very thing. Pay to all what is due to them. Taxes to whom taxes are due. Revenue to whom revenue is due. Respect to whom respect is due. Honor to whom honor is due. Now I want to read just the very next verse. I said I was going to stop at 7. And the Bible, like, that's how they separated the editors. But the very next verse says, owe no one anything except to love one another. For the one who loves another fulfills the law. I think that's actually really good to have verse 8 in there, because that almost negates everything Paul has just said.
Really?
Which Paul does that. So it's interesting that someone who spent time arrested, you know, spent time in jail for defying the authorities or just for religious persecution would write something like this.
Yeah, and I mean, this is part of the problem that I have with people who take the perspective of biblical authority to say, well, it, you know, because it's in the Bible, therefore it's sort of in that absolute truth bucket.
Right.
And we can't ever question it.
Right.
Because I read that and I'm like, really, Paul? Is it really the case that nobody has anything to fear from the law except those who are doing wrong? Because I can tell you that every single solitary young black man in this country can point to examples when they were acting in a completely law-abiding way,
right,
and they got harassed, minimally harassed by the police.
Yeah. And again, and even, like I said, Paul was put in prison multiple times.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, so the question, so what is going on in this passage, right?
Right.
Why is Paul insisting on this point to the Romans, right? What is it that he is... you know, what's really at stake? And I wish I had, you know, a commentary open in front of me so that I could sort of read through, you know, what some of the commentators had said about this. But I suspect that part of the reason he's saying this is precisely because he has an interest in legitimating Christianity in the context of Roman society.
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely the case, because this was a time, I remember that there was a time in Rome when all the Jews were cast out,
right?
And then they were allowed back, and that caused some animosity. That caused a lot of animosity between the Christian Jews who were able to stay and the other Jews who had to leave. And so you have animosity within that community,
right?
But then there's also just this constant moving towards being accepted within the wider culture,
yeah.
And so it's like, keep a low profile,
right?
Don't cause trouble.
Right. Don't give the Romans an excuse to persecute you.
Right. And especially if the Jews might be out to get them too, the Jews might be inciting the Roman authorities, saying, these are the ones you want to get. These right. Christians are the rabble rousers. The Christians are the ones who are causing trouble. They're the ones who you want to be after.
Yeah. And so I think looked at in that context,
right.
You know, you can say, well, you know, Paul is not saying that it is always and everywhere the case that the authorities are just.
Right.
And certainly there are plenty of examples in the New Testament, as you point out, even within his own life, where the authorities acted unjustly toward the Christian community, right?
Right.
And that there are other streams within the New Testament that note that Christians actually may find themselves on the wrong side of the political authorities. And it's what the book of Revelation is about, you know,
right.
I mean,
yeah.
is about political persecution among many other things.
Right.
And the question of what attitude Christians should take toward the worldly authorities. Are the worldly authorities instituted by God, or are they the beast from the abyss?
Right.
And how you react to the worldly authorities has a great deal to do with the question of how you answer that question.
So, yeah, and I know, I think Justin Martyr used this passage, I believe it was him, when he was writing an apology, again, to Roman, you know, authorities, saying, you don't have to worry about us Christians. We even have our own text telling us to be good.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, it might not have been Justin Martyr, but for some reason, he seems to be the one that comes to mind.
Yeah, and I can, I'm not, that particular passage doesn't leap right to my mind, but I think that was the function of this passage in the early church.
Right.
For hundreds of years, that Christians could say, you know, even when they were on the outs with the Roman authorities, clearly we Christians are law-abiding citizens, right, or subjects of Rome.
So, how do you think someone like Martin Luther King Jr. reconciled this passage? I have some ideas, but when saying we are going to do civil disobedience,
yeah,
we're going to break the laws.
Do you know any particular place where King or anybody in the civil rights movement specifically talked about this passage? Because nothing comes to my mind.
I don't know about this passage in particular. I know that what he talked about, he says, you know, you should follow just laws.
Yeah.
If a law is unjust, we break the law. Now, if it says we have to go to jail, you go to jail. So there is this like dance between obey the authorities, that when they come and arrest you, you get arrested.
Yeah.
But break the laws.
Right. And I think that the key, so the place where he talks most extensively about Christian responsibility to obey or not obey the laws that I'm aware of,
right,
is of course the letter from Birmingham City Jail.
Right.
And there, that is precisely the point. And here, by the way, he's using Thomas Aquinas, as we were talking about.
Oh, earlier, right.
Right, because he's using Thomas Aquinas to make this distinction between human laws,
yep,
which may be just or unjust, and the law of God, which is always just. And that when there's a conflict between the human law and the law of God, we have a responsibility to obey the law of God, even if that means we need to disobey worldly law.
Right. So, and I think that's a good rule of thumb. Coming back to this passage from Romans, I wonder if Paul would have written, you know, basically saying, don't worry, you know, don't resist who has been appointed as leader because God has appointed them. I wonder if he would have written that when Nero.
Well, I mean.
And this is before Nero.
Right, exactly. Although, but again, I mean, it's not like there was an absence of examples of poor governance,
right, or corruption,
and of course that's where Revelation comes in again, because Revelation is written in the midst of persecution.
Right.
At this point, of course, Paul is experiencing persecution personally.
Yeah,
you know, and part of the issue, of course, had to do with the question, with the problem of Christians as Christians couldn't obey the law when the law said that they had to treat the emperor as a god.
Right.
Now, of course, going back to the conflict between early Christianity and Judaism, one of the things that Jews had in the first century,
right,
and we always have to be careful about this because, of course, Christian anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism is always in play.
Okay, we're back. So the tension between Christians and Christianity and Judaism and the anti-Semitism is always in play when we talk about that relationship. So we do, we need to be very careful and very delicate.
Exactly. That having been said, part of the issue in the first century was that Judaism was an officially tolerated religion in the Roman Empire, so they had special dispensation to not divinize the emperor in a way that the Christians, particularly the Greek Christians who could not affiliate themselves with Judaism qua Judaism.
Right.
If they couldn't seek refuge in that official toleration because they weren't in any recognized way Jews.
Right.
So that was a problem, is that in that one big way, Christians couldn't obey the worldly authorities. And so because of that, I think that Paul's emphasis is on the idea that therefore they have to obey the worldly authorities in every other way.
Right. Yeah, that's good.
They have to be without stain. as citizens and subjects of Rome, so that this, in this one way, they do not draw undue attention to themselves or bring scandal on the church, right? Which would then, of course, potentially bring persecution because they could not seek refuge in the toleration for not obeying the law that says you have to divinize the emperor.
Right. So, and I think then if we take the verse that I added in, that verse 8, that almost, it kind of does what we're doing. It puts us all in an inclusion, because just beforehand in chapter 12, he's talking about, you know, loving what's genuine, hating what's evil, blessing those who persecute you. He says, do not overcome evil by evil, but overcome evil with good. So he's putting all of that, so like rules of conduct, of how you behave yourself, and really putting that ethic of love up there. After this bit about authority, he continues, owe no one anything except to love one another, for the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. So he's almost taking the Roman situation and putting it in a broader context of following God's law,
right?
Staying true to God, of what God wants. Yes, try to obey the authorities. Try to, you know, pay your taxes. You know, trust that, you know, God's gonna be a part of that. But then don't forget to continue to love others. And I'm wondering if Paul's almost putting it in that rhetorical context to say, like, yes, obey your authorities, but that's not the primary thing. That's not the highest thing.
Well, it's also worth noting, kind of as this chapter continues, mm-hmm. you know, he goes on the next section. As it's divided up in what I'm reading here, is really a general statement that says, besides this, you know what time it is, how right. It is now the moment for you to wake from sleep, for salvation is nearer to us now than it was when we became believers. So this brings it back into the eschatological context.
Right, right.
Because I think what Paul is saying is all of this stuff, right, persecution, paying taxes, obeying the worldly authorities, this is all a temporary condition for you to deal with.
Right.
Right. That the fulfillment of everything that we hope for is imminent.
Yeah.
And so anything that you're struggling with now, you won't have to struggle with it for long because Jesus Christ is coming back.
So I think what we're saying, if nothing else for the listeners, this passage, so, you know, Romans 13 has to be read with a lot of nuance.
Yeah.
To understand where Paul's coming from, that Paul has a sense that you follow him now because it's only going to be for a certain amount of time anyways, so right. You can tolerate the paying your taxes now, and yeah. You know, even if it's Nero, just
yeah,
even though it wasn't for Paul. So that's, you know, so that nuance is really important to keep in mind. The nuance of the corrective of Revelation, how often do you expect to hear that? But Revelation saying, you got to be careful about the authorities. You can't trust them. You know, bring in that nuance. You know, probably as a rule, we don't want to cause trouble. We want to try to be good law-abiding citizens. We want to pay our taxes.
Right. And I think that's the other thing is, you know, again, it goes back to our earlier conversation, right? I mean, when we step out
mm-hmm.
and take that risk of violating a particular norm.
Right.
Why do we do it?
Right.
If we're just generally to use Paul's example, if we're generally lawless, then we're not lawless for any particular purpose.
Right.
Right. If we're like Clive and Bundy, you know, not paying our taxes because we believe that, you know, that we have the right to graze on public land for free.
Right.
And then you're not standing up for any particular principle. You're just standing up for the principle that you don't have to stand up for any particular principle.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, but if you are generally an upstanding citizen, then when you choose to do something like disobey an unjust law, then it is notable because it's exceptional.
Right. So folks, read Romans chapter 13, 1 through 7, and then read verse 8, and then keep going through verse 11. Read all of chapter 13 and read chapter 12 too.
Just read the whole book.
Yeah, read Romans. Just read all of Romans, and then read Revelation, and then do a comparison. And no more than 12 pages, double space.
Right.
Send it to Scott. He'll take a look at it. He'll mark it up for you, and maybe you'll get a grade.
What you into?
What are you into, Scott?
So you know I'm a gamer.
Oh right, yeah.
So but there's a good. I play a lot of role playing games, but this game is actually a board game.
Okay.
And it's called Betrayal at the House on the Hill.
Don't know it.
This is an awesome game. So it's a board game, but the way it's set up is, and you can find examples of it online.
Yeah, I'll link to it.
It doesn't come with a board. What it comes with are a set of tiles.
Okay.
And you randomly draw tiles, and the tiles represent rooms in this haunted mansion that you're exploring.
Hmm.
And so when you draw a tile, you put it down, your characters can move onto the tile, and then events happen. And so the first part of this game is you and your fellow players are all exploring this mansion together, gathering artifacts, spooky things are happening to you. Right. Now, that's fun all by itself.
Right.
But what really makes this game interesting is that at a certain point in the game, and it's random, it happens at a different place every time you play the game, is that a thing happens called the haunt.
Hmm.
And when the haunt takes place, one of the players becomes a traitor. And then it becomes a game where the rest of the players have to work together against the player who's been named as a traitor.
Wow.
And again, that's different every time. And the nature of the haunt is different every time. I've played this game 3 or 4 times.
Mm-hmm.
And it has gone from anywhere from summoning evil demons from the abyss to swallow the haunted mansion to vampires,
right,
werewolves. It's different every single time. There's like 50 or so scenarios.
Oh, nice.
And depending on which cards you draw,
right,
and when the haunt takes place, you get a different story every single time.
Excellent. So what age range would you recommend for this?
I've played it with my oldest daughter, who is 12.
Okay.
And I would say probably not much younger than 10 or 12, but you can play with anywhere from 10 or 12 on up. It's nothing is thematically inappropriate.
Okay, good.
But there are some creepy bits which may freak out younger kids.
Like you don't have like snuff films going on or anything
like that. No, nothing like that. Oh, okay. At least not in any of the scenarios that I've played.
All right. Well, maybe you need to keep playing.
Maybe. Yep.
That that gift suit is in there. It just got weird. So Betrayal at the House on the Hill.
Yeah,
that sounds excellent. I'll link to it on the show notes for people to find that. I am into, and I do this every year. So for the listeners to know, I am into the Austin 100. South by Southwest is coming up. By the time this gets posted, it may have already gone. And that happens, but the show and the website All Songs Considered, which is the NPR music podcast and department, they do great work. Every year, Stephen Thompson is the editor, one of the editors there. He compiles a list of 100 bands that are playing at South by Southwest. He goes through almost all the bands that are going, and he pulls out a song for each band. And you can download the 100 bands, the 100 songs for free.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. 100 free songs. Now,
really?
Yeah. And this is the fourth year I've done it. So now I have 400 songs. and one of the things I really like about it is these are bands I've never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And bands that most likely nobody has ever heard of because they're all South by Southwest. It's all independent. They're up and coming. Very eclectic, so there's at least one heavy metal, like death metal band on there. There's a couple of country and country western. There's always some rap and hip hop, some house music, electric music, and then just indie rock stuff. But I know that when I'm listening to those genres that I would never listen to, I know it's a good representation and a forward-thinking representation of that genre. I trust Stephen Thompson as a music editor to know this is what makes death metal good. Because otherwise, I would have no idea if it's good or not. Yeah.
But, that death metal in particular is hard for me because I often like a lot of the, a lot of the kind of the guitar riffs and drums and but I cannot abide the Cookie Monster growl.
Oh, yeah, and one of the songs has a Cookie Monster growl in it.
Yeah.
But again, I listen to it and I'm like, whew. But I'm like, what is it about this song that makes it good? And so I start to really listen. The rhythms are good. The musicality is good. I mean, So, folks, I'll try to link that. I already put it on the Facebook page because I know by the time this gets out, it probably already be off because it's only up for March.
Oh.
I think that you can download these for free.
I'm gonna have to download it this afternoon.
Yeah, you should really like go to this. You go to NPR. .org/music and just search for Austin 100, and then you should be able to find the download link. But it's I love it every year. It's something I've been looking forward to every year. My oldest son is now getting into. He downloaded the 100, so now we're talking about different songs. And it's a great way to discover fresh, new, upcoming artists. So there we go.
Excellent.
So Scott, great to have you on the show.
It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun, and and we didn't get into a yelling match, even though we talked about politics.
We did. I'll try a new yelling match with somebody as a result of this podcast, though. So.
Good. I hope so. If people want to reach you, do you have any self-promotion that you want to push or anything like that?
Well, you can go to my blog,
Okay.
which
What's
is
the
now I've actually since the last time I was on your show, it now has its own URL.
Oh,
So
so.
it's not a TypePad blog, it's scottpaith.com.
Oh, nice.
So you can go and you can, I haven't posted much lately, but you can go there, you can get links to all of my books and see what I'm interested in reading and
Yeah.
music I'm listening to. And every so often I'll post some new idea or new thought. The last time I posted something was at least a month or so ago, having to do with something involving current affairs.
It's shocking.
It's my jam.
That's right. So scottpaith.com, or you could enroll as a student at DePaul University and sign up for one of his courses. It's a creepy way to get to see him, but
Stalkery, but
the school gets a tuition dollar, Scott gets another student in the class, so it's still fine.
and we have good security in case it's needed.
Right,
So
right. And are you going to go to the next AAR meeting?
yeah, I'm gonna be probably at AAR next year. Where is it going to be next year?
I don't know. I want to say San Diego, but I feel like they just did that.
I just did San Diego. I'll have to look it up, but I'm almost certainly going to go. I'm actually might be doing a panel
Oh,
on
nice.
the TV show The Leftovers.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I
Which
remember when that book came out. That
yeah.
so folks, if you want to see Scott go to the AAR, that's the American Academy of Religion, not the Association of Almost Retired People. Yeah. See, they don't even put the P on there.
That's right. Because we're almost retired.
Yeah, almost retired. Associations of Almost Retired.
That's right.
That's it. No. It's the American Academy of Religion, the largest gathering of theologians and neckbeards in America. Eggheads, too. I can say that because I'm one of them, right?
An egghead or a neck beard?
Right today, either one. If you want to find me, you can come to the First Baptist Church of East Greenwich. If you're in Rhode Island, you're close. So come to East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Our worship service is at 9:30. So on the button, kind of. Come to the go to the show website to find the show notes and to find my blog that I write stuff there occasionally, usually once a month, and that's 12enough.com. You can send any comments about this show, and please, feel free. If you want to rant about how awesome Trump is and how he's the savior for this nation, fine. You can send it. I'll even read some of it. And then I'll send it to Scott because he writes much better responses and stuff like that than I do. Scott is much more liberal with the use of the F word than I am. But you can send those to 12enough@gmail.com. Go to the Facebook page where I post about things happening with the show, if we do live shows, that kind of thing, and that's Facebook/12enough. And as always, thank you very much for listening. 12 Enough is a podcast about Christian faith and culture in the modern age. Your hosts were Jonathan Malone, the pastor of the First Baptist Church of East Greenwich, Rhode Island, and Scott Paith, the associate professor of religious studies at DePaul University. The thoughts, opinions, ruminations, rantings about the falling of the mainline church and the closing of different schools, and about certain politicians and their idiocy and asinine ideas do not reflect their schools, their churches, their families, their denominations, or anything else. These are their own ideas. This is their podcast. And that's it.